Legendary screenwriter Shane Black wrote and directed a terrific action comedy in 2016, with two bankable leads, a terrific premise, and glowing reviews. And it barely made back its budget and was quickly forgotten. Which makes Scott Myers wonder,
why is this not a movie?
Hello and welcome to Why Is This Not a Movie, the podcast where we look at a moment in history or a book or a story we can rip from the headlines and ask Hollywood why no one's ever put it onto the big screen. Joining me this week is Scott Myers, Hollywood screenwriter and author of The Protagonist's Journey, who also runs Go Into the Story, the screenwriting blog for The Blacklist, which spotlights the best unproduced screenplays of the year, which is to say he comes across a lot of stories that need to be made into a movie. Scott, thanks for coming on the show. Tell us about why The Nice Guys needs a sequel and why action comedies have fallen by the wayside.
Yeah, that's two related questions, I think. First of all, I'm a screenwriter, and I've been in the business almost as long as Shane Black. He sold Lethal Weapon, I believe, that first script, a spec for like $250,000 in 1986. I sold K-9, which became, it was an action comedy, and but to Universal in 1987. So I've been tracking his career quite a bit since then. He has a history of writing these type of movies. There's Lethal Weapon, The Last Boy Scout, which sold for $1.75 million as a spec. The Long Kiss Goodnight, Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. He did Iron Man 3, sort of a departure. But then The Nice Guys in 2016. One of the things about his writing is that he's has a very unique and distinctive style. And it has had quite an impact, I think, on screenwriters over the years. William Goldman famously said that screenplays are not a refrigerator manual. They're supposed to be an entertaining read. And when you read a Shane Black script, you're entertained because every single word, not just dialogue, he's great with dialogue, but every single word of scene description has that kind of feel and vibrancy to it. He has a very interesting style. For example, this is the very beginning, page one. Of course, the first page of a screenplay is as important as a novel. In The Long Kiss Goodnight, you see this little girl in her bedroom and she wakes up and she's startled and her mother comes in the shadows and we don't quite see what's going on there with the mom. But then I just copied some of the scene description to give you a sense. He says, "The child subsides, breathing steady, eyes closed. The mother rises, regards her through the dimness, slowly turns, heads for the doors, flicks on a Winnie the Pooh spotlight, dash, dash, new paragraph. Her entire right forearm is slicked with blood." So that's a reveal, right? "More blood on her checkmate MP5 machine gun." Another reveal. "She staggers just a little, barely noticeable, passes out on the light, into the darkness, sits beside her daughter's bed. The child sleeps peacefully. Outside, snow slithers at the glass." I tell my students, I say, when you write scene description, the better way to do that is to write it from a perspective of like, it's more like poetry than prose. And when you read a Shane Black script, even though it's this noirish type of feel, it really does feel more like poetry than a scene description, than prose. So he's
and
a great
I also,
writer.
I also think he made like an easy transition to director because he's writing like a direct, you know, he's not writing a novel. He's writing for a movie. He's seeing it, how it's going to play out on the screen, and not all
screenwriters
do that.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. He's writing it how he sees it, and he's so good that when we're reading it, we see it.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? It's like his individual lines, his paragraphs kind of suggest camera shots. They don't say typically close up or tilt up or whatever, but they suggest camera shots. So he's a really great writer, and I've always admired his style, and he has been quite impactful, his
well,
writing style.
There's a fine line between backseat directing and giving the director a lot to work with, and it seems like he just threads that needle perfectly.
I agree. The Nice Guys is a perfect example of what he does so well, which is he comes up with these really intricate plots. Of course, he was a big fan of some of those crime writers from way back when, like Ross McDonald and John D. McDonald. And he was, I think he grew up in Pittsburgh, if I'm not mistaken, but he was a big pulp fiction type reader, the pulp novels and whatnot. And so he's quite comfortable creating these interesting plots that have lots of twists and turns. But that's really the backdrop for what's special about what he does, is that he creates these characters that you really find interesting. I mean, they're pretty archetypal. It's always a buddy type story, typically. You know, Lethal Weapon was two cops. It was Kiss Kiss Bang Bang was a thief and a private eye. You know,
the long
kiss
he almost kind of invented the modern buddy comedy with Lethal Weapon. With that dynamic of like the loose cannon and the older, you know, grizzled veteran, and all the tropes that came after that movie came from that movie.
You would say, well, I think 48 Hours came before Lethal Weapon.
Okay, all right, maybe I'm giving him too much credit.
But he certainly took it and ran with it, and that's been his parlance. That's been his standard thing that he's been doing for years.
Well, one thing I love about The Nice Guys, too, is that it's very much a Shane Black movie. It's very much in keeping with the previous work. But it's an L.A. noir that is in conversation with the other L.A. noirs. You've got Russell Crowe playing very much the same type of character he played in L.A. Confidential, to the point where Kim Basinger's also in the cast, you know, almost as stunt casting. There's some Big Lebowski thrown in there, you know, particularly when, like, the briefcase opens and all the money flutters away and it's none of it's money.
Not money.
You know, like, that's a very sort of direct Lebowski reference, I feel like. And there's some Chinatown in there because there's this larger political plot going on that they're only seeing the edges of. And, you know, he's very, very aware of the history of these kinds of stories and how they play out. And you can see, like, you can tell, like, we were talking a little bit over email about this, about AI, and something I read recently about one of the new Star Wars, I guess whatever the new Star Wars show is that when George Lucas made Star Wars, he threw in John Ford and Akira Kurosawa and Flash Gordon and World War II dogfights and gunfights and sword fights and pirates and monsters and everything that he liked as a kid. And everything the kids of that era liked got thrown into a funnel, and what came out was Star Wars. And now the only thing they're putting into the funnel is Star Wars. And it's kind of the same thing with this kind of movie. You know, you can write a twisty-turny plot, you can write good characters, but there's so much that's going into the funnel of this movie. You know, it's in conversation with all of these other LA sort of noir movies and all these this sort of classic era noir history with these sort of labyrinthine plots where the heroes are always in over their head and not sure what's going on. And then also the buddy action comedies that he's so good at. It's a rich text while also being just a very silly, like, fun, enjoyable day at the movies.
Yeah, I think that's a very astute observation. I hadn't thought about it, but it does reference, for example, Chinatown. You know, it's a very LA oriented story, and where Chinatown, it was about water rights. You know, here it's about pollution. And back, right from the very get-go of the movie, you see that cloud of smog that was very present in L.A. before they
And in
came
fact,
up with unleaded gas.
One of my small quibbles is there's a moment when they're talking about the smog, and you see a shot of, like, filmed in modern-day L.A. of, like, a clear blue sky. Like, they should have put a filter on that, because that's not what L.A. looked like back in the 80s or back in the 70s.
Yeah, I mean, even to the point where they showed the gas shortage, you know, when the people fighting in line
because they had
the gas, they had a concern about being outside, you know, because of the quality of the air. So he's filtering through these bits that are for people who lived in Southern California, they would remember, but also plays into the plot, which is ultimately it is about automobiles and getting rid of converter, whatever those things they were, you know.
Right. And they're very effective period signifiers that aren't just like, hey, remember bell bottoms and disco? Like, it's actually like the lived experience of people in the 70s.
Oh, I did stand-up comedy for 2 years. There's a couple of shots of the Comedy Store where they've got Tim Allen and,
some
of these, right? You know, so he very clearly was, I mean, I think he loves L.A. I think he has a real, you know, passion for it. And so in a way, it's kind of like a good double feature would be this and Tarantino's Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, because that was 69. You follow it up with this and you've got a real nice flavor.
Oh, yeah.
What the city was
and
like
you know what?
Then.
That before you even said it, that movie came to mind, because it's just, you feel like there are so many details that, like, just things from L.A. from that era that Tarantino loved and just wanted to throw into the movie.
Yeah. And he did it. And he would, I think that's another thing that he does. He figures out these set pieces, like the big party fight scene thing that happens, you know, where Ryan Gosling characters falls down.
Oh, yeah.
That whole thing. You know, I think that took place at, like, some famous architectural house that's in L.A. And So he's like, well, I want to have a big LA party, you know, with beautiful people around, and let's have a big fight and whatnot, and people falling into the pool. So he figures out these cool set pieces that, you know, are, I think, in environments that he wants to exploit and enjoys the possibility of creating an action sequence in that context.
And there are a couple, you know, like Ryan Gosling is constantly falling off of things in this movie, but there are multiple like party scenes where things are happening on multiple levels. Either there's like upstairs and downstairs, and then he falls off a balcony and he's out on the lawn. And there's very much a spatial awareness of things happening on multiple levels, like in the very literal sense.
That's one of the advantages of a buddy story. And Shane Black uses it quite a bit, where they separate and now you cross cut between them. And so action is much more stimulating from a visual standpoint.
And he's got a third buddy in Ryan Gosling's daughter, who's Holly, often kind of entangled in the action, doing her own thing and often bailing out her dad.
So here's my theory on that. And I don't know whether he came up with Leo Getz in Lethal Weapon 2. I mean, you know, Shane, I think, wrote the first draft, but then some of the people came in. But he was like a trickster character, because he would give them problems, create problems, you know, ostensibly an ally, but he would do these things with them and get into trouble. I think Holly's kind of like that in her own way. She's very smart. She's savvy. She's precocious. She wants to be in the middle of things. Meanwhile, her father, Ryan Gosling, is overprotective. Of course, he's lost his wife. There has been a fire. Their house had burned down. So you got that whole backstory. So Holly is interesting, because you don't see that in a lot of the other Shane Black movies, having that third character as part of the triumvirate. But she does remind me in a way of that kind of trickster character, like Leo Getz was in Lethal Weapon 2.
I mean, I guess they kind of do the same thing with Leo Getz, but she's a third sort of member of the dynamic who you can kind of take in and out. Because she's a child, she's not always in on the action, but she shows up unexpectedly when the story needs her.
Like, and literally,
so you can have the two-person buddy dynamic, and then you can throw in the third character to kind of upend things a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, she's like, literally, at that party, she shows up, she's gone into the trunk of the car. You know, she wants to show up and just be part of the action. So that's a really nice dynamic. It also is a way to, not soften, but to explore another side of the Ryan Gosling character, who is, when you see Barbie, you know, he does an incredible job in Barbie, but you see the seeds of what he can do comedically in Nice Guys. There's so many great scenes, like when he's going to break through the glass window with the,
And he just cuts his arm open.
We always see that thing, like, okay, I'm going to use your fist to break through the glass. Well, Shane Black writes the great, he goes boom, and he's just and he passes out, you know, and he gets in an ambulance.
Well, it's also great because we know how things go in these movies, and Shane Black knows that. And so you can upend the conventions, you know, very effectively. Because this, that you know, wrapping your hand up and punching through a window, we've seen that 1,000 times, but you don't see him just cut his, you know, not his jugular, but you know, cut his artery.
There's that bit of business where he's in the bathroom, the public bathroom. That is such great comedic stuff, where he's got a cigarette and he's got a gun and he's got his trousers down and the door
and
is slamming.
And he's trying to cover his junk with a magazine. And like, that was one of those things where like, it's such an extended scene where like the door slams open and closed. And then he's trying to put the gun down. You know, he's trying not to put the gun down, but not to expose himself. And like, how do you, I don't know if you can write that, and whether he was able to direct that note beat by beat, or whether Gosling just made that moment.
Yeah, you know what? I'd have to go back and look at the script. I'm sure he didn't say, you know, the door slamming, you know, that precisely.
But
it's actually an interesting moment, because it's like there's a vulnerability. This is the second time they met. The first time he beat him up, right, and broke his, you know, hand. Now he shows up, and this is Russell Crowe's character. It says, I'm not going to hurt you, but there's a vulnerability to Ryan Gosling being there, hiding his junk with this magazine and being such an inept, you know, a guy. That kind of helps to break down the tension between them and sets up this way in which they eventually become trusting partners of each other.
Well, that's the thing. Like, the first time he and Russell Crowe encounter, Russell Crowe breaks his arm, and then they're almost immediately working together and getting along. And that shouldn't work, and it works really well.
Yeah, well, they have a thing in common. They're trying to find this Amelia character.
Even when they're on opposite sides of things, they understand each other and they understand how the other one works.
Yeah,
and they're both in the same world, and so they get, like, he's just a heavy, he's doing his job.
Again, Shane's got such a an affection for these kind of flawed characters. You know, the Russell Crowe character has actually got some intelligence to him. Ryan Gosling's character likes to think of himself as being pretty intelligent, but they're like that elevator scene where he's going Munich. That's where someone's got no balls. No, Munich is a city. You know, that seems great too. They step
and
on
also
the elevator.
Like Russell Crowe is so dryly funny in that.
Yeah.
Which is not something you necessarily think of being in his wheelhouse, but he was terrific.
Yeah, well, that's key when you've got a buddy dynamic. Somebody's got to play more of the straight guy from time to time, you know.
Yeah.
He allows Ryan Gosling those moments to play his character a little over the top.
Well, this was such a well-made movie, and it works so well on so many levels. And I think this got lost in the introduction a little bit. But your pitch for this episode was, why haven't they done five of these?
Why haven't they? Yeah, first of all, they made Lethal Weapon into a TV series. This would have been a great TV series.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you probably would cast it with different people, obviously. But those two characters set in the 70s and it's a case of the week. You know, I would have been a great TV series. You know, I'm not sure that it would. Well, it didn't do the business. I think it was a $50 million budget and did $65 million worldwide, which is not nearly enough to recoup its.
Well, the funny thing is, I think because of the success of Barbie and because Ryan Gosling's sort of in the spotlight at the moment, there's a lot of stuff online of like, oh, why aren't we getting a Nice Guys sequel? But it'll be, you know, Screen Rant on one of those websites will be like, you know, all the news we have about the Nice Guys sequel. And then the news will be, there is no news whatsoever. You know, it's just everybody kind of, the internet kind of wants this.
It's surprising to me that in the last, I don't know, 6 months or so, I've seen social media people talking about the Nice Guys saying, why don't they make this? Why don't they do a sequel to this? It's such a great movie. It's so entertaining. And of course, the counter argument is, well, it didn't do that well at the box office. But the fact is, it's a really entertaining, enjoyable action comedy. It really is just a terrific film. And so people were responding to it that way.
And clearly it stayed with people. And I think there's a difference that I think maybe the studios don't really take into account of movies that they're able to get butts in seats in opening weekend and movies that stay with people and people are still watching again. Because that's one thing about movie comedies not doing well. There isn't really a secondary DVD market anymore because a lot of the big comedies of like the 2000s, Austin Powers, Anchorman, Office Space, none of them did well in theaters. They did well on home video and on cable when people watched them over and over again. And I remember Office Space had kind of not a great marketing campaign. You know, I think from the creator Beavis and Butthead, I don't think anybody expected it to be as smart as it was. And then people, you know, word of mouth kind of started to spread like, oh, no, this is great. And people watched it over and over again. And the sort of secondary market, I think it probably made money hand over fist, but that doesn't really exist anymore. And I think there needs to be a place for movies to find their audience over time. And, you know, at the moment, going back to instant gratification, there doesn't seem to be a venue for that to happen.
Yeah.
With TV too, like things not only are like Netflix and Amazon and then very quick to cancel a show. If something doesn't find an audience right away, oftentimes it just gets pulled off the streamer like it never existed.
Or they've got it shot and then they're going to deep six it before they even put it on the air. Well,
exactly. Yeah.
Because if, you know, they get like some sort of financial benefit out of that.
Yeah, that part I don't understand at all.
Higher math, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah.
One thing that the strike has proved to me is that these people who are getting paid $40 and $50 million, these C-suite executives, they may not be as smart as Wall Street, the Wall Street Journal makes them out to be.
Oh, I know. Well, the old Hollywood rule is nobody knows anything and they're here to prove it.
Because, you know, why they came to this agreement that they did with the Guild now when they could have done it 145 days ago, the whole town through such misery. And
well,
I think they
really thought they could starve out the writers like they said out loud that they wanted to do. And that for some reason that would be a good thing. And they just succeeded in like not only turning the public against them wholeheartedly, but I think we're sort of seeing more pro-union support in this country than we ever have. Not ever have, but in, you know, since Reagan, at least.
Oh, yeah. And it's like approaching 80% support rate.
Yeah. And I think it's these, you know, $40 million geniuses in the C-suite.
Anyhow, let's see what they do, how they mess with a model that used to work, make it even worse or hopefully better.
Yeah, exactly. But the way Hollywood works right now, they're not making mid-budget movies. And you were talking about this, that they aren't really making action comedies, because I thought the same thing with the John Hamm Fletch remake. You know, that was delightful, and it was a pretty slight, very enjoyable movie that they could have made one of those every 2 years and would have happily spent a Sunday afternoon watching every one of them.
Well, I thought a lot about this because obviously when I sold Canine, you know, that was an action comedy. And I loved, there were so many movies in the 80s and 90s, 48 Hours, Midnight Run, you know, well, Beverly Hills Cop.
Like the backbone of like going to the movies in the 80s.
Entertaining, action, you got your comedy, you know, you're going to laugh, you're going to be thrilled. Yeah, you know, I mean, just so many movies that came out in the 80s and 90s. I don't know, maybe we're too cynical nowadays. Maybe, you know, there have been a lot of dark, edgy movies in the last 10, 15 years, a lot of anti-hero movies and TV series. It does seem like there is a vacuum there, and I'm not sure it needs to be filled as far as the audience is concerned in terms of action comedies, but I wish it would come back, because The Nice Guys is just such an enjoyable movie.
And I think there's some things where, like an example doesn't leap to mind, but I feel like there are things where we're not seeing in the movies so much because we're TV is doing them very well. But there's no action comedy on TV either, really. You know, it's all sort of procedural, Law and Order, Suits kind of things. Like, the closest thing I can think of as an action comedy is maybe Poker Face. But that's such a self-conscious throwback. And that's not that comedic. It's just, it's a very wry, you know, detective story of the week. And
yeah, that's more in the vein of like Columbo, which I wouldn't consider to be, I mean, you know, the character was,
well, no, it's very self-consciously modeled in Columbo, but it's a little bit funnier just because Natasha Lyonne's, you know, such a terrific character, but it's not like, it's a funny drama more than it's a comedy, you know, the way like The Sopranos could be very, very funny, but it wasn't a comedy.
Yeah. No, it wasn't like Fletch.
Yeah. 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 And I don't really understand why there isn't a space in the movie and TV world for this. Because comedy in general is not doing terribly well right now.
No, that's the other thing, is that comedies are not faring too. Like R-rated, that's another area. R-rated comedies used to be big
in
the 80s and 90s, and they've really struggled at the box office. You know, the Jennifer Lawrence one that came out, I forget the title of it, but that may break even. But there have been a lot that have sort of floated out there that are just not even connecting at all. So again, I think there's something going on about comedy. Maybe it's not so much the action, it's that people don't want to laugh or whatever. But then Barbie was really funny, as well as a lot of other things. I don't know. I really don't understand it.
It might be like that somebody has to figure out how to exploit that niche and do it well, because, you know, horror is in this sort of renaissance right now, because A24 did these very thoughtful, clever horror movies that, you know, like Jordan Peele isn't really a horror director in the Wes Craven model. He's doing something kind of new with the form. But also A24 was very good at marketing this stuff. And it seems like they're having success with like art house movies, but doing kind of art house genre movies, doing, you know, horror and sci-fi and things like that. And then there's things that are big at the multiplex, and there isn't, you know, there's been a far from the first person to observe this, but there isn't as much of a middle ground. There aren't a ton of mid-budget movies. And there also aren't, it's kind of bombastic action or small artsy movies. And what used to be the kind of bread and butter, almost like the middle class of the, you know, multiplex, were action comedies and just studio comedies. I don't know where those went. And I don't know how to bring them back.
I don't know either. I mean, I would like to think that people like to laugh. Maybe they get their laughs watching TikTok videos, and they want the spectacle in the movie theater or on their TV screen.
I mean, that is one thing. Comedy is very much about that gut reaction and the immediacy of it. And so I think things like TikTok do work very well for comedy, because it's a very quick thing you're reacting to in the moment. And I think maybe in terms of like modes of entertainment, maybe that's kind of what's eclipsed movie comedies a little bit, because there's a certain amount of setup and plot. And like, I remember like Mitch Hurwitz, who created Arrested Development, once said that if studio executives like focus grouped dinner, then it would be, well, dessert tested way better than salad, so why don't we replace the salad with a dessert? And dessert tested way better than the soup, and dessert tasted better than the main course. And you know what tested better than dessert? Cocaine. Except with, you know, somebody doing like a TikTok video for, you know, 20 seconds, you are just getting a little dessert.
Again, maybe it is instant gratification. You know, I know there's this thing going around because the streaming services, and particularly Netflix, they refer to it as content. They don't refer to these as stories. I think this is where everything started going south as far as the TV and film business goes. But there's this second screen thing. I don't know if you've ever heard of this, but it's like, okay, so they're looking at consumers and they're saying, well, a lot of people will be watching, they'll have a TV on, and meanwhile, they're on their phone. And so they're paying attention here, but they got this going on. So why don't we create content that's like good enough to be on in the background, but not so complex or, you know, require 100% attention? You know,
And that's not a new idea,
it's.
because I remember in the maybe late 90s, early 2000s, whoever was in charge of Comedy Central saying, because they ran a lot of like not terribly good comedies and they ran them over and over again. But they said the reason for that was if like The Godfather's on, you want to watch it beginning to end. But if, you know, if some like teen sex comedy from the 90s is on, you can pick it up in the middle and watch it for 20 minutes and then go on to do something else. And they realized that was their viewership. No one was making like an event of watching something on Comedy Central. They were flipping past the channels. They'd see something that they kind of liked okay and would stick with it for a little while. So it's that same strategy, which like I understand the rationale behind it from like a person running a cable network perspective, but from a storytelling perspective, it's terrible.
It's terrible.
You
It's
know?
like I was joking with a screenwriter friend of mine the other day about the second screen thing. I say, so imagine going in as a writer on a project that they've generated that they want, that they're intending to be a second screen product. And you come in and they say, well, you know what? We like your script, but it's too smart and the characters are too engaging and the dialogue is too crafty. We need to, can you dumb it down a little bit? Like, if they were doing the Blacklist website as opposed to going for people who's got scripts that are like eights and nines, they're going for people who've got fives and fours to try
Although,
and create, you know, it's
I
just.
mean, that's not a new thing either. Like, Police Squad was famously canceled after six episodes because they thought it was too smart, and they thought people weren't getting the jokes. And also, there were B movies in the studio era that were not, you know, intended to be great. They were intended to be on time and under budget. On one hand, you know, it's streaming is a completely new thing we're all kind of contending with, but it's also that same struggle of art and commerce has just been going on since the beginning of time.
Yeah, that's that Charlton Heston had that great quote. Says the problem with movies is art is their commerce. You know, and so you got to balance that out. I
And
mean,
I'm sure if you're a studio executive, the problem with movies as commerce is that they're art.
it's like, well, and that's tough because they're always concerned about, this is where half the conversations in studio notes, just like they're concerned about whether the audience member is going to get it. On TV, this drives TV writers crazy all the time. You know, after the act break, they want to come back and regurgitate what happened in the previous act because they can't assume that the people who are watching the TV show can A, remember what happened, or B, they weren't around, they're just dropping in.
It's a thing. Like, I got rid of cable in favor of streaming a long time ago, and now going back and seeing something on cable, like, it's maddening. In fact, Rachel Maddow did a podcast about the kind of mysterious death of a U.S. senator, and it's a fascinating story. It's the kind of thing, like, you know, this podcast came out of like my love of interesting, weird stories, and I had to stop listening to it because even though it was a podcast, you listen to straight through, she still had that MSNBC format of like, and after the break, we'll tell you more about this. And then when you come back from the break, let's recap everything we've already said. It's just, I can't stomach that, but that's the way so much of like televised entertainment is now.
Well, and I think it's going to probably get worse now that these growth-driven streaming services are now moving into advertising. You have having plateau, you know, that's a platform that's with advertising,
The ad breaks
so
are
you're going
coming
to
back.
have commercial breaks. Yeah, it's a maddening time right now, and honestly, it'll be really curious to see what happened, you know, after the strike has now been, as we're talking, the strike was like literally they announced last night the settlement. You know, what it's going to be like because they're already cutting back on TV programming, you know, the sort of golden age, you know, the golden age, second golden age of TV is, you know, frittering away. And then
Well,
the feature side of
they're
things,
so
I don't know.
overextended.
Yeah.
You know, because you can take the long view and think about like how much TV programming there was in, you know, 2000 as opposed to now, and it's just exploded.
Sure.
But you know, when everybody tried to compete with Netflix and do their own Netflix, like whatever success Netflix had was because there was only one Netflix. You know, if you have 12 Netflixes, there's only so many eyeballs that can look at shows, and like it was unsustainable from the beginning. And even Netflix wasn't, I don't know that they were making any money. They're a little tight-lipped about that.
Well, I mean, that was the big shift. The model here isn't based on profit. The
Right.
model here is based on growth.
Yeah, it's they've thrown over the fabulously successful Hollywood model for the wildly unreliable Silicon Valley model of like speculation. But then
Yeah,
on top of that,
and
you've also got the transition every form of media is going through between analog and digital. I started off in print media. And I still work in book publishing. With newspapers and magazines, we're still in the middle of this transition period where there's not quite enough money from print advertising. There's not quite enough money from digital advertising. And so everybody's kind of foundering and trying to muddle through. And there's going to be a new model at some point because there kind of has to be. It has to stabilize to the point where people can make money doing this or, you know, it all collapses. But I think we're in the same thing where like Paramount is trying to make Paramount Plus profitable and failing, but they're also trying to keep CBS going, whose viewership is, you know, rapidly aging. Everybody's got like one foot in both camps, other than Netflix and Amazon, who are just doing the new thing. But for the old studios, they're trying to still hang on to the old model and keep that money coming in while also trying to, you know, it's like the old thing of like trying to build an airplane while you're in the air, but you're doing that while you're also trying to keep the steam locomotive running at the same time and keep one foot on, you know, and you're taking parts out of it to build the airplane.
they're in the air trying to build it, and then there's this enormous weight, the cargo that's weighing it down, and that's their debt. Yeah, right. I mean, so I think what's going to happen with the so-called legacy studios, which is only five of them now after Disney bought Fox, particularly like Warner Brothers, you're going to start seeing people selling off these parts. I mean, I think Zaslav has, you know, already indicated that's going to be the way, and so CBS will be sold off at Paramount, and Warner Brothers will sell off this, that, and the other thing,
I mean,
because you know, I think $50 billion debt Warner Brothers did when the Warner Brothers Discovery merger happened.
I work for Simon & Schuster by day, who are a division of a division of a division of Paramount, and they just sold us. Not because we're the most profitable division, I think, right now of Paramount because everything else is like a mess. But we had a record year last year, and they sold us to pay off some of their debts. A record year in book publishing is like a middling movie, you know, by Paramount's standards. Like we're
In
a
terms of
tiny
the
little
numbers,
sliver of their pie. So if they
in
can get
terms
a
of
little bit of
revenue.
money for us in the short term, then that's enough
Yeah.
for them.
Well, here's an interesting thing. Taylor Swift, who is a brand in her own, and her father, I guess, is her manager, she's got this movie coming out, which is essentially the Eras, you know, tour
Oh,
movie, concert thing. So they went to the studios, and the studios had this requirement and that requirement, and then they finally just said, screw it. And they went directly to AMC and said, and they made a deal bypassing the studios. And it looks like, I think, $100 million they're projecting, maybe opening weekend, $125 million opening weekend. So it leads you to think, like, well, why doesn't someone like Christopher Nolan, who's got an enormous reputation and an incredible connection with IMAX, why does he need Universal? You know, he left Warner Bros. Why doesn't he raise money and say, I'm going to go directly to the theaters and use my name? So that, you know, that may be one thing we see more of in the future, just because the situation is so in
Oh, I
flux.
think the door's wide open. I wrote something for Subject, this podcast parent website, about the strike and AI and kind of the fear of AI replacing writers. This is a idea I have in my head. I can't necessarily back this up, but I think the studios are in a panic because it's starting to dawn on them. They're looking at AI like they don't need the writers and actors, but I think they're realizing that the writers and actors don't need them. So the digital access that people have to put things out, you don't need the gatekeepers anymore. You need curation because, like in book publishing, anybody can self-publish a book. Most of those aren't very good. You still need somebody to help you find the stuff that's good. And you still, if you're a writer, you still need to be able to find an audience. But I self-published a novel a couple of years ago, and in any other era in human history, I'd be sitting in a desk drawer and nobody would have read it but my wife. Whereas you can put things out there, and between you know, YouTube and TikTok and Vimeo and Instagram and all the platforms that are out there, anybody can put something out, and some people are putting things out themselves that are turning into big things. I said this to you over email before we started that, like, Good Mythical Morning, which was my kid's favorite show for a couple of years, which is two guys sitting at a desk, like, trying weird foods and doing stunts, has a bigger audience than The Tonight Show. And, you know, Mr.
Brett Link,
one of the big YouTubers, is worth like $5 billion. And it was just him doing pranks with his friends, and it got bigger and bigger. And so, yeah, why wouldn't, you know, Brad Pitt sort of produces a lot of movies and puts a lot of money behind them. There's no reason he couldn't produce a short, you know, a limited series or a film and just put it directly in theaters or put it directly onto the web.
Yeah, that Good Mythical Morning, I looked that up and I was like, I've met those guys, Rhett and Link. They've been around on YouTube for years, 15 years, 16, well, 17
it
years.
It took them a long time to build these up. And they're also like, they were in advertising, so they were good at like telling short, funny stories for TV commercials. Like they did local TV commercials and were really successful at it. And they just started doing the show and it just built and built over time. And not everybody has the patience to keep at it with a small audience for years like they did. But now they have this whole, you know, their early shows were like they had an intern, you know, holding the camera straight. And now they have a whole staff of people and production value and all this stuff. And they did a, I don't know, halfway between a sitcom and like a movie in installments on their channel. They're producing like scripted fictional content and it got a big audience and they make money off advertising. And like there's a model there that's already being used. And I feel like a lot of creative people could jump ship and not work with.
Well, now this is where I think comedy could land. Like I live in Chicago, and of course, Chicago is the home of comedy, but typically people go here and then they start here and then go to New York and then go to LA. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I've always thought, wow, that's so, because the talent here is unbelievable. Not only just the comedy talent, but the acting talent. There's like 200 theaters in Chicago, but we have a lot of production here. We don't have a lot of the creative aspect of it here. You know, people will have the writing offices in LA and that sort of thing. But I've often thought, you know, like Broad City did, right? Just get a couple of funny people, and YouTube is a distribution network. You know, just create funny little skits or period, you know, a limited series. And then all it takes is that, you know, Issa Rae did this, you know, with her TV show that eventually ended up on HBO. So to see more of that, I do think that comedy can work as like short form entertainment and just like, do it on your own.
I hate to bring this guy up, and I don't think anybody necessarily wants to hear anything else from HBK, but he did that series with Alan Alda, where he owns a bar, and it was, you know, kind of bleak and depressing, but also still kind of a comedy with his sensibility. But he put it out on his own website, and it was just pay-per-view. It was like a couple of dollars to watch the thing. And as far as I know, people watched that and he made money on it and that model worked. The one thing about that is it's a hard, like the Taylor Swift model, you kind of have to be Taylor Swift. You know, like you and I can't just make a movie and call AMC and get into the theaters. But there are people in Hollywood who could. And there are also people who, you know, there's a long tradition of independent filmmaking where somebody has an idea and they get financing together to do that. And you know, the same way the music industry has kind of changed from a label that controls every part of distribution to you just kind of need somebody to get you onto iTunes. And even that, a lot of bands just have a YouTube channel and a SoundCloud and kind of go direct to the audience. I feel like some model is going to spring up for like filmed entertainment, whether it's episodic or, you know, movies, where you can make your own thing and put it up there and go directly to the audience. And also the, you know, like the means of production are in the hands of the workers, because you don't need to buy film stock, and digital film is very cheap and easy and accessible. And the quality, like the consumer quality, you know, digital video camera is not that far off than what the professionals are using. The tools are not that out of reach. Whereas in, you know, 1985, you know, people were sort of making things on their own with like a Super 8 camera, but to make a professional looking movie was kind of out of reach. And a lot of the independent filmmakers of the era filmed in black and white because it was cheaper. And you don't have those restrictions at all. Like, you know, teenagers are doing like special effects on their, you know, on their MacBooks at home that would have blown away anybody in, you know, 1993. And so I feel like, yeah, I think there's a lot of room for, I guess, independent filmmaking, really, people to put things together on their own without the studios. And I think the studios probably know that and are terrified, which is why they're trying to crack down. And I think that's going to backfire.
Yeah. The theatrical side of things is pretty bleak, really. I mean, though some of the storytelling is great. You know, I see some of these small films. There's one that one of my students made, a graduate student. She graduated Lin Tran. She graduated from DePaul as a directing student, did a wonderful job on a short film that had a festival run. During COVID, they got this house up in a lake in Michigan, and, you know, and five actors. DePaul had, as part of this independent studio thing, that indie studio, they call it, $20,000, and there was $5,000 kicked in from somebody else. $25,000 budget, five people. They go and make this movie, got into Slamdance, and won the Grand Jury Award for Best Dramatic Film.
Oh, that's great.
And it's now got distribution. Byron Allen's company, he just started a first look deal with DePaul because of the success of this movie. And that movie just played here, and it's played in New York. It played here this week at the Gene Siskel Film Center in Chicago. So yeah, there's great storytelling. I mean, there's a movie out that was at Sundance called Fremont. That's like one of my favorite films ever. So there's great storytelling going on. I just watched a movie last night, Terrestrial Verses, by a friend of mine, an Iranian filmmaker. That did very well at Cannes, and now it's getting distribution. But it's still tough. What I'd like is like some billionaire, like the reverse of Elon Musk, billionaire to come in and say, let's disrupt the system, but in a good way. You know, let's, as opposed to making one $300 million movie, let's make 100 $3 million movies.
Yeah, exactly. You know,
right? And just open the door for compelling stories of any genre.
I also feel like just as a pure cold-hearted business person, if you made 100 $3 million movies, some of those are going to take off and you're going to make your money back.
Yeah, that would be the bet, right?
And all you need is maybe a sounder business strategy than putting all your eggs in the one basket of, you know, the Avengers or whatever if you make a $300 million movie and it bombs, then your studio goes out of business. If you make, you know, 100 $3 million movies, you know, there's no real worst case there.
That's the theory. With audiences, they've been so trained. This is my concern with AI. The audiences have been so trained with this content generation philosophy to see regurgitated material, sequel, sequel, sequel. It's basically the reimagining, barely, of the original content. You know, there's been 34 Marvel movies, and people now are finally starting to think, well, maybe they kind of burned out on this, right? The AI is, I'm not worried about AI being able to replicate Aaron Sorkin or Shane Black or whatever in terms of the quality of what I am worried about is what the suits think it's capable of doing. You know, if they're just thinking in terms of content, oh yeah, sure, we can have some project manager come in, we'll hire him for $75,000 a year to develop treatments, and every week we go out and seek writers to come in, and now they're not writing an original story, they're writing an adapted thing, so that lowers the amount of money they have. They own the content even though it's all been stolen.
You don't have to pay royalties to somebody who's just editing what the AI did.
It's really strange. You know, they've been scraping movies in AI, and you would think that Paramount and Warner Brothers and Universal, all those people would be going, no, we're going to sue your ass because you're taking our material.
Right.
They're not. And I think the reason they're not suing is because they want to use AI. They don't want it.
They want to take everybody else's material.
Yeah, they want AI to be part of the business proposition going forward. So if they were to sue it and potentially have all these copyright issues and whatnot arise. But you're in the publishing world. I see where authors are now doing this. Like some big name authors just recently came out and they're suing.
Yeah, that made me really happy to see, because like I'm friends with an author who, you know, posted a long thing about how like AI is a misnomer. It's not artificial intelligence. It's not, there is no intelligence, and it's not what computer science researchers would talk about as artificial intelligence, a machine that can think for itself and come to conclusions. It's a plagiarism machine. It just takes things that already exist and, you know, looks for patterns and makes a copy. There's no intelligence involved at all. But the only thing it really does is just plagiarizing things that already exist and kind of regurgitating that. The one thing, though, is I do, to a certain extent, trust audiences to have a pretty good bullshit detector. Talking about the Marvel movies, I think that the first wave of them were very popular because they were giving people something they hadn't seen before. This whole interconnected thing where, like, you know, Iron Man shows up in Captain America and Captain America shows up in the Hulk, and they're all interacting with each other across all these movies. And there's this ongoing storyline that connects 24 movies. Nobody's ever done that. That was insanely ambitious, and they pulled it off. You know, there was a lot of sort of flack from like cinephiles of like not real filmmaking, but just as a purely like, from a technical, not even a technical standpoint, but just kind of a logistic, like it was just a thing nobody'd ever attempted, and they pulled it off. And I was just very, very impressed by that. But it's not a trick you can pull over and over again. It's not new anymore. And so audiences kind of, okay, what else you got to show me? You can't just do that again. The success of like Barbie and Oppenheimer this summer, even though Barbie is a very, very, very well established, brand name, they handed that to a very like original and idiosyncratic filmmaker and let her put her own stamp on it and do something we hadn't necessarily seen before, because it didn't play like the sort of 2-hour toy commercial everybody thought it was going to be.
Well, this goes back, I mean, to loop Nice Guys back into it. One of the reasons why that movie is such a good film, in my estimation, is the characters are just so specific and interesting, and we care about them. And so if you look at Barbie, yeah, it's got all this stuff going on, but at the core of it, it's two characters who are having an existential crisis. Barbie is wondering, who am I? And so is Ken. Who am I without you? Right. And so they both go through a classic. I mean, I saw an interview with Margot Robbie, and she said that Greta Gerwig said to her, "This is a hero's journey for you." She said, "I've never done a hero's journey movie." And it really is a classic hero's journey where she goes, leaves her ordinary world, goes out to this new world, comes back, changed by it. Right. And Oppenheimer, similar sort of thing. That's three acts. There's 3-hour-long storylines. One is, genius and ego trying to get the gig. Then he gets the gig. And there's that whole sort of not despotic type thing, but he's like the leader of this whole thing. And then there's that big moment where he sees the actual explosion leading to the third act, where it's like, this is super dangerous. We need to do something to kind of corral this. Both of those movies, yeah, they're big, wonderful, and got all sorts of things going on. I mean, Barbie's got this whole sort of satire about patriarchal system that's just great, and Ryan Gosling again playing it to the hilt. But at the core, you've got these central characters who are facing these credible issues of self-identity, which to me is what story is all about. I mean, every story is essentially a protagonist in search of who they are, and
Right,
so
same. And like my biggest thing as a writer is that every decision you make has to inf be informed by the characters, and has to inform. The only reason for a plot is to put your characters through an experience that illuminates who they are. And
yes.
the movies, it doesn't really matter. Like s story setting, it all matters less than you caring about those people. Caring about them in the situation that they're in and relating to them and understand. It's every movie ultimately is, that works is about human nature, because that's the thing that we're endlessly fascinated with.
Well, that's why I think the Marvel movies are suffering in that regard. Like, of all of them, like Logan, I really liked Logan a lot because that was like a Western. And it was
Oh,
about
yeah.
this guy dealing with his own destiny and being hooked up with this kid. It was very relatable. It's like a father-daughter type story, right?
But on
So,
top of that, it's also about like aging and facing death.
facing death.
Which isn't a
Yeah.
thing, like Batman never gets, Batman's always in his 30s and he never dies. And
Yeah.
so it was something, again, it was something we hadn't seen before. And I think you can keep doing these superhero stories if you find new ways to do them and new ways to make us look at these characters in a new way.
Yeah, I mean, if it's always about, well, the universe is in danger, okay, for the 35th time, the universe is in danger. The specificity of it, this is what Pixar has done so well for over the years, is they find these specific characters in a unique subculture, whether it's the water or monsters or cars or whatever. But the issues that they deal with are deeply human. They're universal, often about separation. Someone dies, or they lose a friend, or they get lost, which are really deeply primal things for us as human beings. I mean, there's a reason why they call it separation anxiety when you're a child. And so you have stories that are tethered to the deeply unique and nuanced experience of being a human being. Those are the ones that resonate because we care, because we identify with the characters going through them. This is my theory of one of the reasons why I think my book came out at a good time, was if you want to safeguard against AI, this is the way to do it. Character-driven stories, because there's no way that AI can ever understand the complex nuance of human experience. Only we can. And each person has their own unique life experience and unique life perspective that they can bring to their storytelling. So right there, you're on a path to doing something, regardless of what the genre it is and regardless of what the story concept is. If you've got characters who are compelling that we care about, well, there you go. That's the path toward getting noticed by somebody who's going to say, I connect with that. I can see with that. That would be a good story to tell.
And the thing that makes characters work so often is just specificity. That's
Yes.
not really something a formula can produce.
No, it is. It's the you find the universal in the specific. I mean, like one of the truisms of writing 101. You know, you don't just describe something generically. It's always about what specifically is going on. So the characters, you know, Barbie, they're dancing along, having a great time. She says, "Anybody here think about death?" Right to scratch. You
Well,
know, she's thinking about mortality.
that's part of the brilliance of Barbie is that you take a concept, Barbie as the toy is supposed to be universal and have almost no specifics. She's supposed to appeal to every girl and like sort of represent every woman because she has every job. And yet Greta Gerwig made her such a specific character with specific concerns. And I don't know that
She
that
was
many
stereotypical
characters.
Barbie. She was. The other characters had their own specific unique. Well, this is a nurse and this is a judge, and she's stereotypical Barbie. She's like the Barbie qua Barbie, the original one. So, anyhow, I just think that I guess the one takeaway out of all this, including nice guys and where the state of the film business is and TV business is and AI, is for writers to lean into their characters, to create characters that we care about. I tell my students, I say, character, care, actor. They're like actors creating these characters who we care about. You know, if you've done that, great. You're on your way to writing a good story.
All right, so that's our movie, or in this case, I think our frustration with movies like The Nice Guys not being able to find the success they deserve. But I think that will be an ongoing issue for many years, unfortunately. But thank you so much to Scott Myers. Check out gointothestory.blckist.com, a terrific resource for anyone interested in screenwriting or storytelling in general. Same goes for his book, The Protagonist's Journey, which you can get from your local independent bookstore. If you have any thoughts on Nice Guys, action comedies, or ideas for other movies that need to get made, hit me up on Blue Sky at Mike Vago. And you can read student journalism, reviews of Star Trek Lower Decks written by me, hear college radio, and listen to other lesser podcasts on our parent website, subjectmedia.org. We'll be back in 2 weeks on
Why is this not a moon?